May it please the court, Mr. Mike McCool, we present argument on behalf of the petitioner.
If it pleases your honors, in 1941, Callejo's predecessor in title granted a general easement to Brazos to construct a 69,000-watt electric transmission line across the property that was later purchased by Mr. Callejo. The general easement also gave Brazos the right to construct, operate, and maintain this transmission line. In 1985, Brazos filed this condemnation suit to secure a 60-foot wide easement to construct, maintain, and operate a 138,000-volt transmission line. Callejo admitted Brazos' right, power, and authority to condemn, and the only issues that remained to be determined was the amount of damages due to the owners. Four special issues were submitted to the jury. Number one asked the jury to find the market value before the condemnation. And the jury answered that issue, $456,161. Issue two asked the jury to find the market value of the permanent easement after the condemnation, and the jury answered $364,928.80. Issues three and four respectively asked the jury to find the market value of the remainder of the Callejo property before the condemnation and after the condemnation. The jury found the same figure as to issues three and four, and thus issues three and four are not in dispute and make up no part of this appeal. Brazos moved for judgment on the verdict in the amount of the jury verdict, and Callejo moved for judgment NOV and asked the court to disregard the jury's answer to special issue two because it was not supported by any evidence. The trial court rendered judgment NOV, and the Court of Appeals held that the evidence of the witnesses as to the market value of the permanent easement before the condemnation could be used as evidence by the jury as to the market value of the permanent easement after the condemnation, and reversed the trial court's judgment NOV and rendered judgment in the amount sought by Brazos. Points of errors numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4, the points on which the court granted our application for writ, are to the effect that the Court of Appeals erred in reversing the trial court's judgment NOV in holding that the evidence by the witnesses as to the market value of the permanent easement before the condemnation could be used as evidence as to the market value of the permanent easement after the condemnation. Permitting the use of the value of the easement before the condemnation as evidence in determining the market value after the condemnation is clearly wrong. It's bad precedent and bad law. Simply put, the market value before the taking, without any of the restrictions and conditions of the value after the condemnation merely gives you evidence as to the market value of the permanent easement before, and certainly has no probative value as to the market value of the easement after, because the factors and the conditions after the easement is taken are very different than what they were before the condemnation. To consider the market value before the condemnation as evidence for market value after the condemnation is clearly improper and doesn't take into consideration the factors, the damages that result as a result of the condemnation. For example, the mere fact that all of the expert witnesses and all the witnesses that testified in this case damaged the market value of the permanent easement at least 50%, all the way to 100%, proves conclusively that as far as all of the witnesses are concerned, there was a great difference as to the value after than the value before. Mr. Don Moore and A.C. Mosier, expert witnesses for Mr. Colejo, testified that the market value of the permanent easement after the condemnation was damaged 100%, that it had no value after the condemnation. The evidence showed that Brazos put in two large steel poles, 80 feet high, one large steel pole, 85 feet high. The evidence also showed in this case that these large poles are unsightly and objectionable to a majority of prospective purchasers. Most developers are required to discount land near the large steel poles. Lots are least desirable and usually the last one sold. The easement restricts the development of property, and you can't get the full use of property when the easement cuts across your property as it did Colejo's property. Also, some of the residents who either live or work near these high voltage electric transmission lines complain of loud humming noises when the weather is humid and raining, thundering or lightning. Brazos put on two expert witnesses, Mike McClellan and Wesley Snyder, and both of those expert witnesses said that the market value after the condemnation was damaged 50%. Thus, every witness that testified in this case said that the market value was damaged at least 50% because of the 60-foot wide strip that cut across Mr. Colejo's property. And the damage was from 50 to 100%. Moore testified that the value of the permanent easement before the condemnation was $655,000, Mosier $643,000, and Colejo $729,000. Brazos' experts testified, Snyder testified, $67,082. McClellan testified, $67,082. The jury found $456,161 to issue one. That issue was within the evidence. There's no question. But as to the issue, as to the market value after the condemnation, Moore testified that after the condemnation, there was no market value, that it was damaged 100%. Mosier testified it was damaged 100%, no value. Colejo testified it was damaged 100%, no value. Snyder testified that the value after the condemnation was damaged 50%, and that its value was $33,541. McClellan testified that it was damaged 50% and the market value after was $33,541. The highest figure after was $31,541. The jury answered that $364,928. There is no evidence anywhere near the $364,928.80 that the jury found. Thus, the jury's finding of $364,928.80 is not within any range of any of the witnesses and is in fact $331,387.80, more than the highest evidence given by Brazos' appraisers, or 10.8 times higher than any of Brazos' appraisers, and is infinitely in excess of the value set by Callejo's witnesses. There is no evidence whatsoever to justify the extent to which the jury departed from the testimony. The jury's finding in response to issue number 2 is clearly wrong and therefore should be disregarded. The obvious error of the Court of Appeals opinion is that the evidence by the witnesses as to market value of the permanent easement before the condemnation can be used by the jury as evidence in determining the market value after the condemnation, and this is erroneous. Such testimony and evidence merely goes to the value of the land before the condemnation and not after. Such evidence has no substantive or probative value at all as to the market value after the condemnation. The landmark case pertaining to general easement was decided by this Texas Supreme Court in Houston Pipeline Company versus Dwyer, wherein a pipeline company was given a general easement not prescribed by meets and bounds. And that's the same as this 1941 easement, general easement, that was given to Callejo's predecessor in title. There was no meets and bounds. The Supreme Court held that once the pipeline company installed a line across the property, its action defined and fixed the extent of this easement, and said, quote, the grant which was before general and indefinite becomes fixed and certain, and the grantee cannot change the easement either by relaying the pipe in another place or in increasing its size, end of quote. The Dwyer, and that is exactly what the predecessor of Callejo had in this case, that was in effect when Brazos condemned this property in 1985. The Dwyer case was followed by Pioneer Natural Gas Company versus Russell, wherein the court refused to allow a pipeline general easement to be widened just 10 inches so that a second pipeline could be laid 40 years later. In our present case, the 1941 general easement was fixed by the action of Brazos when it originally installed the 69,000 watts electric transmission line, and which Brazos had the right to operate and maintain. But under no circumstance did that extend the general easement to a 60-foot wide easement, which Brazos later secured by this 1985 condemnation case. In Lieber versus Texas Municipal Power Agency, a 1984 Court of Appeals case, writ refused NRE, wherein the percentage of reduction in the value of the easement before the condemnation and after the condemnation was off only 11.7% from the testimony of the expert witnesses. The court found no basis in the record to justify the extent to which the jury departed from the expert testimony. In our instance case, wherein Brazos experts found 50% damages to the permanent easement after the condemnation, and the landowner's witnesses found 100% damages after the condemnation, while the jury in this Colegio case found only 20% damages to the permanent easement after the condemnation. Thus, the jury in the instant case was 30% off from the testimony, while in the Lieber case, the jury was only 11.7% off. And yet, the Lieber opinion said it could find no justification for the extent to which the jury departed from the testimony. In this case, the jury departed more than 2.5 times, or nearly 3 times, as in Lieber, and there certainly is no basis to justify the extent to which the jury departed in this case.
Counsel, this is the place to stop you. I've got a question that's been occurring to me during your argument. The value of real estate before and after, and in a matter of condemnation, is established by opinion testimony.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There's no hard and fast proof of market value before or after of a piece of property. It depends upon what people say, both experts and owners, that it's worth before and after. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, sir.
What's bothering me is the Coxon versus Atlantic Life case that says that the finder of fact is not bound by what opinions are about values, but that the jurors can use their own experience and common sense. And I wish you'd try to distinguish those cases.
Yes, sir. Well, it isn't just a question of opinions. Let me point that out to begin with. These witnesses, these expert witnesses, are extensively cross-examined. They're cross-examined as to the facts of the particular case. They're cross-examined as to the comparable sales they use. They're cross-examined as to every point that's involved in the case. And it's not just a question of opinion. The opinion has to be backed up by reasonable and logical facts.
But it's still an opinion.
It's still opinion. That's true.
Even after all the cross-examination is over, it's still an opinion.
Yes, sir. But if it's not logical or reasonable opinion, the jury doesn't have to believe it. And the jury can believe whatever it feels is reasonable and logical. But still, there must be, Your Honor, some kind of opinion, some kind of evidence. That opinion is some evidence. Now, these expert witnesses, for example, in this case, Mr. Mosier, for 46 years has been practicing real estate in Dallas County. He's an active real estate broker. He's been in the business for 46 years. He's been very active in it. He's been appraising. He's been doing this work. And that's where you can get to the facts of the case by cross-examining these witnesses. And if they don't make sense, if they're not reasonable, they're not going to be believed.
Am I correct, though, that a jury is not bound by the testimony of the experts as to value before and after?
I would think that the jury has to be bound by the evidence that's given concerning it, and that is evidence. It is wrong to say that they can just not be bound by what is given as evidence, unless the court says it's not evidence and throws it out. Because well, what doesn't let it be admitted.
If they're bound by the evidence, then Coxon versus Atlantic Life, that says they can take their own experience and knowledge into consideration, is not the law.
Well, to me, if everything else, if the court admits it into evidence, admits the opinion into evidence, it's evidence.
I agree, it's evidence.
And the jury has to be bound by the evidence. There's no question that juries just can't go outside of the evidence. Now, they can use their experience, all right, in trying to balance what's reasonable, what's logical, and these other things. But to say that the jury can wholly just not believe any of the opinions given by the witnesses, I think is wrong.
Well, let me ask you, sir, on that same line of thought. Are you saying that the jury is bound to pick a number between
the lowest testimony, the lowest value, and the highest value, that they cannot come in with a higher number or a lower number than the testimony that they hear at the condemnation trial?
That's correct.
Is there a case that says that?
That says that it must be?
Within the limits?
Well, I think all of our cases of law says that there must be evidence. Now, what happened here? There was no evidence as to issue number two, except for what I told the court was evidence.
Was that one objected to, issue number two?
No, ma'am. It was not objected to. Of course, we don't ever know what the jury comes back until it's all over with, you understand? But what the jury came back at to issue two, there was no evidence. There's no question about it. 10.8 times higher than what's there. I have never seen a case where there was as much damage to the remainder from 50 to 100%, at least 50% damage, caused by the condemnation. Even the experts felt that this condemnation caused serious damage.
What percentage of the tract was taken?
I don't know that I can tell you the percentage of it. It went through, that is, it went on the edge of the track. It went through the track where you had 300-400 feet on one side and more than that on the other side. But I don't know what the percentage of it is versus the whole track.
Who tendered the special issues to the trial jury?
Who tendered the special issues?
Who prepared and tendered them? Or did the judge just draw them up on his own?
No, I think both sides presented them, but there was no objections to the special issues that were submitted.
We wouldn't be having a problem here today if you'd simply submitted it broadly, find the difference in market value.
Yes, but they don't do that in condemnation cases, Judge. I wish that there would be a way that could be done. And if you rule in this case that's the way it should be done, then we'll start doing it.
Well, is there any reason other than habit, or other than what some treatise says left over from prior to 1973, why you could not submit a condemnation case on that single differential issue?
You know, you start law.
Forward value and after.
Well, yeah. I know that. I'm asking him if he knows any legal impediment to not doing it that way.
Only because the attorneys always want, whether it's tort, whether it's condemnation or anything, want to get as many issues as they can get to be determined.
Why? And confuse the jury or some other reason?
No, because they think it aids their side, the judge. A little bit better if they could have another issue in this or that. And this has been customary to do this. I started in the condemnation in 1949, and then it was just settled practice that you had four issues in the partial taken. You have only one issue in a total taken, which makes it easier. But if you come out and say that that's the way it ought to be done, and I hope you do, I think it'll help the condemnation law, and you won't have this type of situation. You can just give one issue the amount of damages sustained by the owner as a result of condemnation in dollars and cents.
Well,
I think that would, Judge. I think that would be very helpful.
Can we put an if any in there?
If any, yes. That would be all right.
Any further questions? Put that in discussion.
Thank you,
Mayor. We're now ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please support Mr. Patrick Millar present argument on behalf of the respondent?
May it please the court, my name is Patrick Miller. I represent the respondent, Brazos Electric Power Cooperative, Inc. This is a condemnation case. The taking is the reconstruction of an electric transmission line. Trial was to a jury. The trial court granted the petitioner's motion for judgment NOV. The respondent, Brazos Electric, appealed, and the Court of Appeals reversed and rendered the judgment, reinstating or rendered judgment in the amount of the jury verdict. The writ was granted on no evidence points. My argument will address those points, and my brief addresses the other points. I'm going to refer now and from time to time to a chart on page 10 of my brief. This argument necessarily involves a lot of numbers, a lot of figures, some percentage analysis, and it will be helpful, and I will refer to the chart on page 10 of my brief now and from time to time during our argument. On December 9, 1941, the owners of the 130.718 tract granted an easement and a 69,000 or 69 kV electric transmission line was built and operated for some 38 years on this 130.718 tract. A few years ago, the respondent determined that a line of greater current carrying capacity was necessary to serve the area. The line was reconstructed at the same location. There were four H-frame structures of wood construction on the property, and each of those structures was replaced by a single steel pole, so there were four poles replacing eight that had held the property for some 38 years. At the trial of the cause, respondent called two expert real estate appraisal witnesses. Again, I'm going to refer to the chart on page 10 of my brief. They testified as follows: that by virtue of that 69,000 volt electric transmission line, the value of that 60 foot easement strip that was going to be the subject of the reconstruction was 50 cents per square foot. I would convert these damage figures to per square foot figures because they're just easier to handle that way. He testified that the total 130-acre tract, a very valuable tract, was worth $2.50 a square foot, and because that power line had been there, was there, and had been there, that the 60-foot easement strip before the taking was worth 50 cents a square foot, 20% of the value of the remainder. After the taking, respondents' witnesses testified that this property would be reduced in value, damaged at will, an additional 10%. 25 cents a square foot, so that before it was worth 50 cents a square foot, after it was worth 25 cents a square foot. As to the remainder, the respondent's witnesses found no damage. $2.50 a square foot before and the same after. Thus, in the opinion of these witnesses, the total damages was $33,541. The petitioners, the landowners, called two expert witnesses, and Mr. Callejo himself testified as an expert witness. Again, my chart on page 10 reflects that those witnesses testified that the value of the whole tract, this time including that 60-foot strip burdened with the 38-year-old easement and existing transmission line, was worth either $4.80, $5, or $5.50 a square foot. That the after-taking value, that is, after reconstruction of the transmission line, the property within the strip was worth zero. $0. 100% taking. Rendering damage is somewhere between $737,907 and $643,987. the jury's findings, again, converted to values per square feet. We're at the value before, $3.40 a square foot. The value after, $2.72 per square foot. The remainder, before and after, $3.40 a square foot. No damage to the remainder. They found total damages of $90,232.20. That equals to 68 cents a square foot. That also equals to 20% damage to the strip because of the reconstruction of the line. Now, the petitioner's contention in his motion for judgment NOV was that the jury's answer to special issue number 2 had no support in the evidence and should be disregarded. The trial court disregarded that finding and substituted in its place $33,541, or 25 cents a square foot, which was the highest value testified to of the after-taking values. It was either 25 cents a square foot or zero. And the court substituted his finding for the jury's 25 cents a square foot, wherein the jury found $2 a square foot. But this court in 1983, in Trinholm versus Ratcliffe, held that a motion for judgment NOV should be granted only if there is no evidence upon which the jury could have made the findings relied upon. To sustain the action of the trial court in granting the judgment NOV, it must be determined there is no evidence to support the jury's findings. The appellate court must review the record in the light most favorable to the jury findings, considering only the evidence and inferences which support them, and rejecting evidence and inferences contrary to the jury's findings. Now, I want to examine the evidence tending to support the jury's findings. But first, I want to reiterate, for emphasis, in your holding of November 1987, Standard Fire Insurance Company versus Morgan, 31 Supreme Court Journal 69, quoting, the appellate court must consider only the evidence and inferences supporting the jury's verdict, and they must disregard all evidence to the contrary. I emphasize that rule because the petitioner's briefs and arguments do just the opposite. His brief cites only evidence and inferences contrary to the jury's verdict and ignores any evidence that might support it.
Can you show us any place in the record that would support the verdict of the jury?
Yes,
that the after taking value was $300,000+ or whatever it was after the
jury. Refer to my chart on page 10. The jury found that easy.
Counsel, I hate to tell you, but most of us don't have your brief right here before us. We just have the memorandum of the court. Now, some of them have the brief.
Sure.
Well, I've got one now, but...
And I'll try to supply the figures as I go along. The jury found that the EFIT strip was damaged 68 cents per square foot. The petitioner's witnesses testified that it was damaged somewhere between $4.80 and $5.50 a square foot. The respondent witnesses testified that it was damaged 25 cents a square foot. The evidence and the inferences from the evidence was that it was damaged 68 cents a square foot. That is squarely between what the petitioner's witnesses said and what the respondent's witnesses testified to.
Now you're talking about the 60-foot easement.
Yes, sir.
Not the remainder, but the
not the remainder.
Okay.
And we're really not addressing the remainder here except peripheral. But the easement was damaged 68 cents
a square foot,
according to the jury, and that is squarely between 25 cents a square foot, as the power company's witnesses testified to, and the landowner's witnesses testified to, between $5.50 and $4.80 per square foot damage, because they damaged 100%. And I think that evidence clearly supports the jury's verdict.
And that is the evidence that the
appellate court must look to determine whether the judgment in LB granted was proper. And I might go further. In Trinholm versus Ratcliffe, this court said every reasonable intentment deducible from the evidence is to be indulged in the respondent's faith. And this is certainly one way of looking at it, just like the petitioner looked at it the other way. But I think that's what the appellate court must do. I think that's what the law says the appellate court must do. We'll determine the propriety of the judgment in OV. As to the percentage analysis,
the
petitioner's witnesses testified that it was damaged 100%. The respondent's witnesses went to great length in saying that the whole tract was worth $2.50 a square foot. That because there was a power line already there, it had been there for 38 years. The value, therefore, of that 60-foot strip where that power line was located didn't have as much value as the remainder. It was valued at 20% of the value of the remainder, 50 cents a square foot. And he said that the reconstruction of the line would damage it an additional 10% for the value of the remainder. Again, we must look to the reasonable deductions from the evidence, to the evidence and the inferences that tend to support the jury's verdict of 20%, squarely between 100% and 10%. The Court of Appeals,
through the years, have addressed this question.
Very simply put, it's this. Usually, and I say usually because I think that State versus Carpenter set out how these issues are to be presented in a whole taking case or a partial fee taking case. The
second and third questions would be relevant, but in a
easement taking case, there are two questions that ask, what is the value after? Special issue number two asks, what is the value of the strip after? Special issue number four asks, what is the value of the remainder after? And the Court of Appeals in seven cases, which I cite on page 8 and 9 of my brief, consistently, following the rule of Coxon versus Atlanta Life Insurance Company, have said that when all the witnesses testify to an amount that's lower in these after-taking values than the jury comes in with, there is evidence to support that jury finding. Now, each of those cases went to great length to analyze
and
to
draw
a line between no evidence and insufficient evidence. Analysis. Each of these cases said
there is
evidence to support the verdict. Therefore, a judgment in OV would be improper.
Each of these cases
went on to analyze the factual sufficiency. They handled the legal sufficiency and they went on to analyze the factual sufficiency of the evidence. And some cases were reversed and some not, based on factual sufficiency. And that is where the argument of all these the cases, especially in Lieber, cited by the petitioner, that says here the petitioner, here the jury departed 11%, or here the jury departed 30%.
These are insufficient evidence arguments,
and we are not here on an insufficient evidence point. We are before this court on a no evidence point. There was no insufficient evidence point preserved from the trial court and none considered by the Court of Appeals. The court quoted from Coxon versus Atlanta Life Insurance Company saying a jury is at liberty to reach its conclusion by blending all the evidence admitted before them, aided by their own experience and knowledge of the subject of inquiry. They are not compelled to credit all the testimony of any witness or to reject it all. The Court of Appeals in the case before us today said opinion evidence is not conclusive. A jury may consider, accept, or reject such opinions, or it may find its own opinion from the evidence, and by using its own experience in matters of common knowledge. And they quote Lieber versus Texas Men's Power Agency. There are three limiting restrictions on the jury when considering the value of the easement after the taking. And that's the Maddox versus Gulf Colorado and Santa Fe Railway Company, cited in my brief at 293 Southwest Circuit 499. The jury is confined only by the lowest figure testified to. And if all the witnesses say the property is damaged, the verdict must reflect some damage. Again, the jury is confined only by the lowest figure testified to. The jury must higher than the lowest figure testified to. So the finding was supported by evidence. I want to address several issues raised by the petitioner's brief and argument. The petitioner cited Lieber versus PBA as I just did. And I want to again point out that that case does not stand for the proposition that the trial court can grant a judgment NOV on the basis of insufficient evidence. That is, after considering all the evidence, the finding was wrong or unjust. The only way that and a trial court can grant a judgment in 08 is that there is no evidence. That is, the evidence is legally insufficient. The argument that the petitioner advances that the evidence of the value of property before the take cannot be used when the jury is considering the value after the take
fails it out
in our own analysis
of the jury's answers.
The fact that we can argue that
comparatively
the findings were 10% or 20% or 50% or 100%
merely pleasant.
The fact that we can analyze these facts by using a ratio, and we don't have any reason to believe that the jury should not or could not do the same thing.
It goes right
back to Coxon versus Atlanta Life Insurance Company. They have the right to write all the evidence. This argument says that these special issues must be answered in a vacuum
without considering certain properly admitted evidence,
and that's not reasonable. That argument denies several very important principles.
That the appellate
court must consider all the evidence tending to support the jury's finding. That the jury is the judge of the credibility of the witnesses and the weight of the evidence. It denies that the jury is entitled to weigh all the evidence and make its decision from the evidence. The petitioner's brief and argument is positioned to have the court impose a logical and restrictive formula by which to analyze the jury's findings at the fact. The question was raised earlier about law for submission. In the condemnation cases that we try, we submit the issues based on the State versus Carpenter
guideline,
which is a value before, value after
situation,
and it does involve many times jury verdicts that have the characteristics of this one. That is,
when
in these after-taking values, the jury comes in with a value higher than any of the witnesses
testified to the after value. I think looking at that,
the jury has used its common sense. The jury has blended all the evidence and is denying or failing or refusing
to believe
parts of some testimony
and taking
other parts of the testimony,
which is their right,
which is their duty
under our system.
If you looked at the broad form submission
issue,
if you looked at the results in this case, the jury found $90,000
damages
in its charge. That is squarely between $33,540 testified to by the respondent and the $2 million damages testified to by the petitioner.
That is your knowledge.
Condemnation law, would you have any
legal
or philosophical objection
to
bond
for
commission
and partial taking?
No, sir. I think that it would be a lot different.
But
according to the rules, I think that's the way we're going, because
these
issues that we see here are somewhat the rationale of the State versus Carpenter was good
in that it sought
to
sever
the easement away when the jury was considering damages, so that double damages would not be awarded the landowner. If they awarded the damages to the easement, and they awarded the damages to the remainder. Therefore, they severed it out and set it in
four special issues, and that's
the rationale. As long as the appraiser, the expert witness, and all the parties knew that those were going to be the rule, I think they could set up and find their values or their damage values that way.
So you can do it in 10 issues?
Or in
one? I
think you can do it in one. What are the damages? But right now we're going to look into the State versus Carpenter. And as far as these special issues were objected to,
I don't think they were,
because they were submitted just like every condemnation case I've seen submitted.
With maybe
very subtle differences in wording.
Do you see any need to change the way that they are submitting have been for many years?
No, not particularly.
Are you having any problems with them?
No, sir.
Need to throw out many years of tradition and stare decisis to get one issue and step over it, you know?
No.
I think that the system works
quite well.
As long as we apply the rules of court of appeals that allows the jury to blend all the evidence and come up with a finding. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, Jim.
Judge, I don't think he ever told you where the evidence was on issue two, because there is no evidence. The highest figure is $33,541 is the highest figure. The jury came back with $364,928.80. Now that's absolutely no evidence as to that. He comes in on a per square foot. The jury wasn't asked about per square foot. It's per square foot has nothing to do with the amount of damages. Now he says because of 20% comes between 10% and 50%. I don't know where he gets that. Let's find out what the damages of the jury was. The damages of the jury was $456,161 on issue one. Issue two was $364,928.80. That is 20%. Their appraiser said 50%. Our witnesses said 100%. Now you tell me how you get a 10% in there somewhere. It's not there. The difference percentage-wise is 30%. The jury was 30% off. It wasn't within the evidence. It just isn't there. Briefly and simply put, to set aside the trial court's judgment, the Court of Appeals said we can use the $729,000 that they testified to in regard to the market value of the permanent easement before the condemnation. That's the way they got it. And the court, you read the court's opinion, $729,000. That was the highest figure. But that wasn't on the market value after the condemnation. It was on the market value before the condemnation. And that's your whole difference here. Simply put, there is no evidence. There was no evidence. And I don't care whether you want to top it at square feet or anything else. It doesn't come out. It doesn't give you any evidence. Not one iota of evidence. And I say to you, with no evidence, then the trial court was absolutely right in doing what it did. And its judgment in OV that it granted was correct. And I say to you that that trial court judgment should be reaffirmed, and the Court of Appeals judgment should be reversed. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court will now take a brief recess.